Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. And then from 1 John chapter 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. As you can probably gather from some of the things that have already been said this morning, we're hearing from several students who experienced semesters abroad. If you didn't look closely at the cover, I'm always amazed. David Ketter does all our covers, and he just gets creative. So how many people could take half of the Colosseum and then insert the temple at Jerusalem alongside of it? But two of our students will be speaking, Deanna Brody, who spent a semester in Rome, and David Doyle, who spent a semester at the Jerusalem University College. Please welcome Deanna.
Hello. When I boarded the plane to Rome last January, I had a lot of vague expectations. I expected adventure and exploration. I expected good food, good artwork, and good music. I expected to miss people, and especially miss playing with my volleyball team up there. I expected, above all, to travel and to see things I had never seen before, to swim in foreign seas, to ride a gondola in Venice, to drink espresso, to sword fight in the Colosseum, to speak Italian, and to do as the Romans do. Some of those expectations were fulfilled. I swam in the Aegean Sea. I rode a gondola, though it was sickeningly overpriced. I drank a total of one espresso and ended up liking cappuccinos a whole lot better. I didn't sword fight in the Colosseum, but I did walk through it, the overwhelming weight of its bloody history pressing down on my chest. I spoke a mingled sort of Italian English. I went to Rome expecting to see spectacular things, and I did. But I also went expecting to learn easily packaged little life lessons that I could send home on neat postcards or in compact emails. And though I did learn a lot in Rome, none of it was neat, none of it was compact, and none of it was what I expected. The greatest lessons I took away were lessons of humanity, lessons about people and the dual nature of our condition, depraved and yet made in the image of God. These two ideas, which I had memorized in Bible class freshman year like everyone else, were never more real to me than in Italy. Rome was the farthest thing from the Geneva bubble, and the majority of people I met and interacted with in Italy were not Christians, nor were they raised in a culture founded on Christian principles, as America is. It might not be shocking, then, to hear that I saw a new type of depravity during my time in Rome. Firstly, the gender differences were blaring. Men treated women, especially women they didn't know, rudely from an American point of view. It isn't rude to point in Italy, or to whistle, or to comment on a woman's nice figure or the lack thereof. The occasional rare occurrence in America became the many times daily occurrence in Rome, and it was upsetting to be on the receiving end of that. On top of that, to see ad after ad plastered on billboards and magazines of barely clothed women clearly being shown and being seen as objects made me sincerely appreciate American gender culture, which, though clearly imperfect, is founded on a desire for equality and respect. But the casual defacement of women was not the only manifestation of this new level of depravity. In Cinque Terre, which was one of my all-time favorite places in Italy, two of my friends and I walked into a coffee shop, and we were standing at the counter looking at the menu, and the man behind the bar leaned over and stared at the little fish that I've worn around my neck for 5 years. Jesus, he said, why are you wearing that? He's not real. I opened and closed my mouth about 5 times before I managed to say, yeah, he is. Clever. I know. Compelling argument I made. But the unabashed denial of the existence of Christ, which, though it might happen in America in a political rally or in an anonymous blog online, would almost never be uttered in a public business by a man who is supposed to be serving his customers. There were several occasions in Italy when I saw a darkness that seemed thicker and more tangible than it ever had before. And yet that semester was 3 of the best months of my life. The reason being that I saw God's grace and beauty in creation and in people more than I ever have before as well. If you go to Geneva, you know that people are made in the image of God. We memorize it. And yet I'm surrounded by a lot of people who on most days act like it's only human beings who love God look like him. And that simply isn't true. Coming from an entirely non-Christian home, I have already known that you didn't need to know amazing grace to be amazing. I knew beauty was enhanced by a relationship with God, but that beauty was present in people whether they knew him or not. This knowledge, which sometimes gets lost in my mind here at Geneva, was reinforced tenfold in Rome. The people of Italy, though depraved, just as we are, and often unbelieving, were some of the most shining people I've ever met. Their depravity did nothing to hide their likeness to God. Christ shone forth from their every movement, and the craziest part was that they had no idea. We met Lucy within the first few days of landing in Rome. She was our very Italian professor, and I instantly loved her. She had a light about her that made you want to be near her. She shone with a beauty that didn't show her years. She was filled with knowledge and wisdom and a joyful humility. Though Lucy worked several teaching jobs and struggled to support her daughter as a single mother, she laughed like a rich woman. My friend Rachel and I attempted to describe her, and we threw away several weak adjectives before we settled on the short description of, she has the spirit, you can tell. As the week started sliding by faster and faster, and we spent more time with Lucy, I came to realize how sad I would be to leave this wonderful lady. On our last day of class in Rome, she took my face in her hands, and both of us in tears, she said, don't be sad. We will see each other again, Deanna. I am sure of it. If you know me at all, you know I cried like a baby at those words. Getting to know Lucy was just the start of seeing the Lord wherever I went in Italy, shining even more brightly in the atheists and agnostics than he does in many Christians. My friends and I met a 79-year-old man named Vincent, who spoke very little English, on one of our train trips. He was off to visit his daughter in Milan. Through many long pauses, our own broken Italian, and some pretty hysterical miming, we learned his whole history. He had another daughter in America, a son in Naples, and 6 nephews, no nieces, which he kept repeating. We spent a few good hours with that man, watching the rolling hills fly by outside the window, and listening to his beautiful Italian spilling out stories of trips and soccer games and family gatherings. When it was our turn to debark, he kissed each of us once on each cheek. And in some of the only English he knew, he said, good girls, you good girls. I cried then too. The last thing I want to tell you about is the people at the corner bar. It was a coffee shop just a few feet away from our campus. Every single one of those employees made me love Rome like a home instead of a vacation spot. I'm a big coffee fan, so I was down there at least once a day. It was sort of my Italian Bifcat. And the people there were magical. It was a life we became a part of for those few months. We were regulars at this little bar. The staff knew our names, made fun of our Italian, and in many ways, became our friends. And we loved them like friends. There was Antonio, Paola, Beatrice, Pierre, Alessandro. They ate dinner together on Thursday nights, a big family-like meal, and then sang karaoke after that. And being with them felt like a family away from our own. On our last day in Rome, they wished us well and raised their glasses to their amici americani. Surprise, surprise, I cried. Beatrice hugged me tightly and whispered in my ear, tanti, tanti azzurri per tua vita. It means the best of luck, or well wishes, Or my favorite translation, every happiness for your life. As I came to know and love these Italians, I came to recognize there was a sense of yearning about them, a desire for something that wasn't being fulfilled. They lived happily, but there seemed to be an underlying hint of discontent as well. When I finally thought about it, I supposed that it was God that they were looking for. And though the language barrier and my own timidity kept me from telling them about God, I prayed for my Italian friends. And I think the Lord worked in spite of me. This wooden fish got a lot more attention in Europe than it does here. Several people stared at it. A few daring ones made comments. Some were negative, like the guy we met in Cinque Terre. But one man I met in Athens glanced down at my necklace, smiled, and said, "You believe?" And when I nodded, he clasped my hands in both of his and said with utmost sincerity and warmth, "Congratulations," as if I had won something. And when I think about it, I have, though I've done nothing to deserve the victory. As I traveled through Europe, it was impossible not to see God in these people. They were undeniably his image. And though many didn't know him, perhaps had never experienced his presence consciously, or spoken him, or even thought of him, they carried his likeness. They were his children, doing his work unknowingly. I think oftentimes the brilliance of our godly image gets lost beneath the dark knowledge of our sinfulness. Last semester, I was reminded at the importance of seeing both sides clearly. I saw the two extremes of humanity in an intense, life-altering way in Italy. I came home choked up over the power of God, over his vastness, over the beauty and care with which he made our physical world with its breathtakingly blue oceans and overwhelmingly huge mountains, but also over the searing love and grace with which he made our species. It was easy to feel God in Rome, easy to see him in the cobblestone streets and in the eyes of the people, easy to hear him in the chatter of rapid Italian and in the roar of fountains. It was easy to experience him, and experience him I did. Thank you.
Well, as has already been said, last fall I had the wonderful privilege of studying abroad in Jerusalem. And though my time there was filled with many wonderful events, I got to do many wonderful, exciting things, such as go to the Qumran caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, especially interesting to me because I'm a biblical languages major. I was able to sit on top of Mount Carmel and think about Elijah and the priests of Baal, and the prayer of Elijah, and God's vindication of himself that day. I got to hike down in the Negev, swim in the Sea of Galilee and in the Dead Sea. Wonderful things. But the most important thing that I learned, that I experienced over there, was a better understanding of the importance of the land of Israel in the Christian faith. Now, what do I mean by that? Do I mean that I have been to the land of Israel, you have not? Sit back politely and allow me to one-up your Christian experience. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. Rather, the land of Israel is important, not because I get some vague, mystic feeling about God's presence there that I really can't explain or impart to you and thereby bless you with. No, the land of Israel is important because it is a living, real witness to Jesus Christ, his person and his work, and also to God's divine activity in the space of 1,500 years. Ever curious whether the conquest of Joshua really happened? Go to Israel. Go north to the town of Hazor. See that town that Joshua burned thousands of years ago. Curious whether the Babylonians really did invade Judah for their unbelief? Read the inscriptions of Lachish, sent to Jerusalem. Lachish was the second most fortified city in all of Israel. And in some of the inscriptions from Lachish, we read that they can no longer see the signal fires at Azekah, because the Babylonians are there, implying, we're next. We're next, guys. Or do you ever wonder why the Israelites were so obstinate and foolish and faithless in the face of God's wonders and the awesome power that he demonstrated before them through Moses and through his prophets? Go to the land of Israel. See how little water there is. See how many rocks there are. How hard to farm it is. And then take a look at the coastal plains where the land is really good and realize, oh, that's where the Philistines live. No, the Israelites have all the hill country. Even though the land of Israel is a land flowing with milk and honey, the reason Scripture says that is because it's a land good for trade. It's along many trade routes. The land itself is a hard land. It's a hard land to live in. But yet, the land of Israel is a wonderful land precisely for that reason. Through the Scriptures, we see that God uses that land to build faith in his people. Elijah goes out and is nourished by ravens in the wilderness. That's faith. The faithlessness of the people are all around him, hardened by the frustration of farming land that does not yield much, hardened by the frustration of waiting on rains that do not come, hardened by all these things. They turn away from God. And so the land is better than they. It kills their faith. But no, for the faithful, God has given them the land to strengthen their faith, to build them up, to encourage them, to devote them to him. So, ultimately, what is this land? How did it teach me when I was over there? I saw this land as a witness to the presence of God. Presence of God, yes, Jesus Christ. But again, as I've said, the presence of God in directing his covenant people in Israel. The entire land bears the mark of divine action. Go from town to town, go from place to place. See what God has done amidst the Jewish people that are still living there. The people that God has preserved through all of these generations. And we won't get into dispensationalist arguments there, that's not my point. But the land is a witness to God's presence by being there. In our day and age, especially for me, a philosophy major, how tempting it is to abstract the Scriptures. But how can you abstract the Scriptures when the very thing that the Scriptures are talking about is in front of your eyes? 1 John 1, verses 1 to 3 was read here today. And we can no longer touch and see Jesus Christ physically, in the flesh. But we can see the places where he walked. We can see the towns where he ministered. We can read about in independent witnesses of the people that he touched, the actions that he did. These are wonderful things. These are things that confirm and refresh our Christian experience as we read the Scriptures and understand them not to be speaking of things up here, to be speaking of things in front of our eyes. And so that land was a wonderful witness for myself, particularly in that way. And secondly, the land's witness is a witness to what we as Christians ought to call home. The Israelites struggled in this land. They fought with the enemies around them. They fought with the rocks themselves. It would take a year to terrace 1 acre of farmable land. For 1 year, a man comes to a new place, he can't farm anything, he has to clear out rocks for an entire year. This is fighting. This is struggling. This is not the home that we want. So what is the purpose of the land of Israel? The purpose of the land of Israel is to point us to our heavenly home, a home in which we don't constantly have to clear out rocks, physical rocks, and also the rocks in our spiritual lives. The land of Israel is a place that points us toward Jesus Christ and to the heaven that he is preparing for us where we can rest with God. For now, we journey as the Israelites in a land not our own, confident that we will receive a city above because of the pilgrim identity that Jesus Christ has secured for us, looking towards something better which is to come.